but Roy saw it coming. He ducked, and Dana's fist connected solidly with the fiberglass bird feeder. Once Dana stopped howling, Roy said, "Every time you try to hurt me, something bad happens to you. Haven't you noticed?" Dana was doubled over, shaking his injured hand. He glared up at Roy. "Like yesterday," Roy went on, "when you tried to kill me in the janitor's closet, remember? You ended up getting whooped by a girl, stripped naked, and strung to a flagpole." "I wasn't naked," Dana snapped. "I had my underpants on." "When you go back to school on Monday, everybody's going to be laughing at you. Everybody, Dana, and it's your own stupid fault. All you had to do was leave me alone. How hard is that?"
"Yeah, well, they'll be laughing even louder when I kick your skinny ass to kingdom come, cowgirl. They'll be laughing like hyenas, only you won't be around to hear them."
"In other words," Roy said irritably, "you haven't learned a thing."
"That's right, and you can't make me."
Roy sighed. "The only reason I came over here was to talk things out, put a stop to all this dumb fighting." That had been his mission. If only he could make peace with Dana Matherson, even temporarily, then he'd be free to focus his energy on solving the mullet fingers dilemma. But Dana hooted in his face.
"You must be crazy. After all the crap that's happened to me, you're so dead, Eberhardt. You're so dead it ain't even funny."
Roy realized it was no use. "Hopeless, that's what you are," he said. "By the way, that's a cool shade of purple." He pointed at Dana's swollen knuckles.
"Get out of here, cowgirl! Now!"
Roy left him there on the porch, pounding the front door and bellowing for his father to let him in. Evidently, the lock had clicked behind him when he'd come outside to take a punch at Roy. It was a funny scene. Dana hopping up and down in his baggy boxer shorts, but Roy wasn't in the mood to enjoy it. He hid his bicycle and snuck through the hole in the fence. In broad daylight, the junkyard didn't look so spooky, just cluttered. Still, Roy had no difficulty spotting the rusty old panel truck with JoJo's ice cream and snow cones painted on the flimsy awning. Beatrice's stepbrother was in the back of the truck, zipped into a moldy sleeping bag. When he heard Roy's footsteps, he stirred and cracked one eye. Roy knelt beside him.
"Brought you some water."
"Thanks, man."
Mullet fingers reached for the plastic bottle.
"And thanks for last night. You get in trouble?"
"No big deal," said Roy.
"How do you feel?"
"Like cow poop."
"You're looking better than you did," Roy told him, which was the truth. The shine had returned to the boy's cheeks, and his dog-bitten arm no longer appeared puffy and stiff. A blue button-sized bruise was visible on the other arm, where the boy had yanked out the intravenous tube before fleeing the hospital.
"Fever's gone, but I hurt all over," he said, squirming out of the sleeping bag.
Roy looked the other way while he put on some clothes.
"I came to tell you something. It's about the new pancake house," Roy said. "I talked to my dad, and he said they can build whatever they want on that land, long as they've got the legal papers. There's nothing we can do."
Mullet fingers grinned.
"We? All I mean is, you're saying it's a lost cause, right? Come on, Tex. You gotta start thinking like an outlaw."
"But I'm not an outlaw."
"Yeah, you are. Last night at the hospital, that was definitely an outlaw move."
"You were sick. You needed help," Roy said.
Mullet fingers finished off the water and tossed the empty bottle. He stood up, stretching like a cat.
"You crossed the line. And why?" "'Cause you cared about what happened to me," he said to Roy. "Just like I care about what happens to them weird little owls."
"They're burrowing owls. I've been reading up on them," Roy said.
"Which reminds me, they probably aren't too crazy about hamburger meat. They eat mostly bugs and worms, according to the bird books." "So I'll catch them some bugs," the boy spoke with a touch of impatience. "Point is, it ain't right what's happening out there. That land belonged to the owls long before it belonged to the pancake house." "Where are you from, Tex?"
"Montana," Roy replied automatically.
Then he added, "Well, actually, I was born in Detroit, but we lived in Montana right before we moved down here."
"Never been out west," Mullet Fingers said, "but I know they got mountains."
"Yeah, awesome mountains."
"That's what we need here," said the boy. "Florida's so flat, there's nothing to stop them from bulldozing one coast to the other."
Roy didn't have the heart to tell him that even mountains aren't safe for machines like that.
"Ever since I was little," Mullet Fingers said. I've been watching this place disappear. The piney woods, the scrub, the creeks, the glades, even the beaches, man. They put up all these giant hotels and only goober tourists are allowed. It really sucks.
Roy said, same thing happens everywhere.
Doesn't mean you don't fight back. Here, check it out.
From a pocket of his torn jeans, the boy produced a crumpled piece of paper.
I tried, Tex, see? Had Beatrice write a letter, telling him about the owls and all. Here's what they sent back.
Roy smoothed out the paper, which bore the Mother Paula's company emblem at the top. It said, Dear Ms. Leap, thank you very much for your letter. We here at Mother Paula's All-American Pancake Houses, Inc. take pride in our strong commitment to the environment. Every possible effort will be made to address your concerns. You have my personal assurance that Mother Paula's is working closely with local authorities in full compliance with all laws, codes, and regulations. Sincerely, Chuck E. Muckle, Vice President for Corporate Relations.
Lame, Roy said, handing the paper back to Beatrice's stepbrother.
Yeah, it's just a, what you call it, a form letter. Didn't even mention the owls.
They stepped out of the ice cream truck into the sunlight. Ripples of heat rose from the junk cars, which were lined up in rows as far as Roy could see.
How long are you going to hide here? He asked the boy.
Till they chase me out?
Hey, what are you doing tonight?
Homework.
In truth, Roy had only one short chapter to read for Mr. Ryan's history class, but he wanted an excuse to stay home. He sensed that Mullet Fingers was planning another illegal visit to the Mother Paula's site.
Well, you change your mind, meet me you know where at sunset, the boy said. And bring a socket wrench.
Roy felt a strange mixture of apprehension and excitement. Part of him was worried about the tactics used by Beatrice's stepbrother, and part of him was rooting for the kid.
You've been sick, Roy said. You need to rest up.
Ha! No time for that.
But the stuff you're doing, it won't work, Roy persisted. It might slow things down, but it won't stop them. Mother Paula's is a big company. They're not going to just give up and go away.
Neither am I, Tex.
Sooner or later they'll catch you, and then you'll end up in juvenile hall, and
then I'll run away again. Same as always.
But don't you miss, like, a normal life?
Can't miss what you never had, said Beatrice's stepbrother.
Roy detected no bitterness in his voice.
Maybe someday I'll go back to school, the boy went on. But for now, I'm about as smart as I need to be. Maybe I can't do algebra or say, nice poodle in French, or tell you who discovered Brazil, but I can make a fire with two dry sticks and a rock. I can climb a coconut palm and get me enough fresh milk to last a month.
They heard a motor start and ducked back into the ice cream truck.
Old guy who owns the place, Mullet Fingers whispered. He's got an ATV. It's super cool. Goes flying around here like he's Jeff Gordon.
When the growl of the all-terrain vehicle faded away toward the other side of the junkyard, the boy signaled that it was safe to leave the truck. He led Roy on a shortcut to the opening in the fence, and they slipped out together.
Where are you headed now? Roy asked.
I don't know. Maybe do some recon.
Recon?
You know, reconnaissance, Mullet Fingers said. Scope out targets for tonight.
Oh. Aren't you going to ask what I got planned?
Roy said. It's probably better if I don't know. He considered mentioning that his father was in law enforcement. Maybe it would help the boy understand Roy's reluctance to participate, even though he sympathized with the owl crusade. Roy couldn't bear the thought of facing his parents through jail bars if he and Mullet Fingers got caught.
My dad works for the government, Roy said.
That's swell, said the boy. My dad eats Hot Pockets and stares at ESPN all day long. Come on, Tex. I got something way cool to show you.
The name's Roy.
Okay, Roy. Follow me.
Then they took off running again. One summer in the late 1970s, long before Roy Eberhardt was born, a small but powerful tropical storm boiled out of the Gulf of Mexico and came ashore a few miles south of Coconut Cove. No one was injured or killed, though the 10-foot surge caused heavy damage to buildings and roads along the waterfront. Among the casualties was a stone crab boat called the Molly Bell,
which was torn from her anchorage and swept up a swollen tidal creek, where she wallowed and sank from sight. The storm blew itself out, the surge waters receded, and there, sticking halfway above the surface, was the lost crab boat. And there she stayed, for the creek was so slender and the current so tricky and the oyster bed so perilous that no salvage captains would risk their own vessels to retrieve the Molly Bell. Each season she grew more shrunken and dilapidated, surrendering her sturdy hull and deck to the ravages of woodworms, barnacles, and weather. After 2 decades, all of the Molly Bell that showed above the surface was the sloping, bleached roof of her pilot house, just wide enough for 2 boys to sit side by side, faces upturned toward the sun, legs dangling over the pale green creek. Roy was dazzled by the wondrous quiet, the bushy old mangroves sealing off the place from the honking and hammering of civilization. Beatrice's stepbrother closed his eyes and gustily inhaled the salty breeze. A lone osprey hovered overhead, attracted by a glimmer of baitfish in the shallows. Upstream, a school of baby tarpon rolled, also with lunch in their minds. Nearby, a white heron posed regally on 1 leg, in the same tree where the boys had hung their shoes before swimming to the derelict boat.
2 weeks ago, I saw a crocodile in here, 9-footer, remarked Beatrice's stepbrother.
Great, now you tell me, Roy said with a laugh.
The truth was, he felt totally safe. The creek was incredibly beautiful and wild, a hidden sanctuary, only 20 minutes away from his own backyard. I might have found this place all by myself, Roy thought, if I hadn't spent so much time moping around being homesick for Montana. The boy said,
It ain't the crocs you gotta worry about, it's the mosquitoes.
Have you brought Beatrice out here?
Just once. A blue crab bit her on her big toe, and that's all she wrote.
Poor crab, said Roy.
Yeah, it wasn't pretty.
Can I ask you something?
Anything but my name, said Mullet Fingers. I don't want one, and I don't need one. Not out here.
What I wanted to ask about, Roy said, is you and your mom. What's the deal?
I don't know. We just never connected, the boy said matter-of-factly. I quit sweating it a long time ago.
Roy found that hard to believe.
What about your real dad?
Never knew him, the boy shrugged. Never even saw a picture.
Roy couldn't think of what to say, so he quietly dropped the subject. Downstream, a disturbance shook the water, and a dozen silvery, cigar-sized fish jumped in unison, trying to escape some hungry predator.
Cool, here they come!
Beatrice's stepbrother pointed at the frantic V-shaped wake. He got flat on his belly and instructed Roy to hold his ankles.
What for? Hurry up, man! Come on!
With Roy anchoring his feet, the boy scooted himself forward over the rim of the pilot house until his wiry upper torso was suspended out over the creek.
Don't let go!
He yelled, stretching his tan arms outward until his fingertips touched the water. Roy's hold began to slip, so he pitched forward, exerting his full weight upon the boy's midsection. He expected them both to go tumbling into the creek, which was all right as long as they didn't scrape any oyster bars.
Here they come! Get ready! I've got you!
Roy managed to hang on as he felt the boy lunge. He heard a grunt, a splash, and then a triumphant,
Woohoo!
Grabbing the boy's belt loops, Roy pulled him safely back onto the pilot house. The boy flipped over and sat up beaming, his hands cupped in front of him.
Take a peek, he told Roy.
The boy was holding a bright, blunt-headed fish that sparkled like liquid chrome. How he had snatched such a slippery little ghost from the water with only his bare hands, Roy didn't know. Even the osprey would have been impressed.
So that's a mullet, Roy said.
Yep, the boy smiled proudly. That's how come I got the nickname.
Exactly how'd you do that? What's the trick?
Practice, the boy replied. Trust me, it beats homework.
The fish glittered blue and green as it wriggled in his palms. Holding it over the creek, the boy let go. The mullet landed with a soft plop and vanished in a swirl.
Bye, little guy, said Beatrice's stepbrother. Swim fast.
Later, after they paddled to shore, Roy's curiosity got the best of him. He heard himself saying, Okay, you can tell me now. What's going to happen tonight at Mother Paula's? Mullet Fingers, who was shaking a snail off one of his new sneakers, flashed a mischievous glance.
There's only one way to find out,
he said. Be there.
15. Roy sat cross-legged on the floor, gazing up at the cowboy poster from the Livingston Rodeo. He wished he was as brave as a champion bull rider, but he wasn't. The Mother Paula's mission was simply too risky. Somebody or something would be waiting. The attack dogs might be gone, but the company wasn't about to leave the new Pancake House location unguarded for long. In addition to a fear of getting caught, Roy had serious qualms about trying anything illegal, and there was no dodging the fact that vandalism was a crime, however noble the cause. Yet he couldn't stop thinking ahead to the day when the owls' dens would be destroyed by bulldozers. He could picture the mother owls and father owls helplessly flying in circles while their babies were being smothered under tons of dirt. It made Roy sad and angry. So what if Mother Paula's had all the proper permits? Just because something was legal didn't automatically make it right. Roy still hadn't settled the argument between his brain and his heart. Surely there had to be a way for him to help the birds and Beatrice's stepbrother without breaking the law. He needed to come up with a plan. Glancing out the window, Roy was reminded the time was slipping away. The shadows had lengthened, which meant that the sun would be setting soon and that Mullet Fingers would be on the move. Before leaving the house, Roy poked his head into the kitchen, where his mother stood over the stove. "Where are you going?" she asked.
"Bike ride."
"Another one? You just got back. When's dinner? It smells great."
"Pot roast, honey. Nothing special. But we won't be eating until 7:30 or 8. Your dad had a late tea time."
"Perfect," Roy said. "Bye, Mom."
"What are you up to?" she called after him.
"Roy?" He pedaled at full speed to the block where Dana Matheson lived and chained his bicycle to a street sign. Approaching the house on foot, he slipped unnoticed through a hedge into the backyard. Roy wasn't tall enough to see in the windows. He had to jump and hold himself up by his fingers. In the first room, he saw a thin, rumpled figure lying prone on a sofa, Dana's father, holding what appeared to be an ice pack to his forehead. In the second room was either Dana's mother or Dana himself, wearing red spandex pants and a ratty wig. Roy decided it was probably Mrs. Matheson, since the person was pushing a vacuum cleaner. He lowered himself and resumed creeping along the outside wall until he reached the third window. And there, sure enough, was Dana. He lay sprawled on his bed, a lazy blob in dirty cargo pants and unlaced high-top sneakers. He wore a stereo headset, and his head was jerking back and forth to the music. Standing on tiptoe, Roy tapped his knuckles against the glass. Dana didn't hear him. Roy kept tapping until a dog on the porch next door began to bark. The next time Roy levered himself up to peek into the room, Dana was glowering at him through the window. He had pulled off the headset and was mouthing some words that even an amateur lip reader could have figured out. Smiling, Roy dropped to the lawn and took two steps back from the Matheson house. He proceeded to do something that was drastically out of character for a boy who was basically shy. What he did was salute crisply, spin around, drop his pants, and bend over. Viewed upside down, which was how Roy saw it, Dana's wide-eyed reaction suggested that he'd never been mooned in such a personal way. He seemed highly insulted. Calmly, Roy pulled up his trousers, then strolled around to the front of the house and waited for Dana to come hurtling out the front door in a fury. It didn't take long. Roy broke into a brisk jog with Dana no more than 20 yards behind him, cursing and spluttering vile names. Roy knew he was a faster runner, so he measured his pace. He didn't want Dana to get discouraged and give up. Yet after only 3 blocks, it became evident that Dana was in even worse shape than Roy had anticipated. Steadily he ran out of steam, the angry curses dissolving into moans of fatigue, the name-calling into sickly wheezes. When Roy checked behind him, he saw that Dana was gimping along in a lopsided half-trot. It was pathetic. They were still 1/2 mile from where Roy wanted to be, but he knew Dana wouldn't make it without pausing for a rest. The sorry load was about to keel over. Roy had no choice but to pretend he was tiring too. Slower and slower he ran, falling back in the chase until Dana was practically stumbling at his heels.
Familiar, sweaty hands clamped down on his neck, but Roy realized that Dana was too worn out to throttle him. The kid was simply trying to keep himself from falling down. It didn't work. They landed in a heap, Roy pinned on the bottom. Dana was panting like a wet plow horse.
"Don't hurt me! I give up!"
Roy peeped convincingly.
"Ugh!"
Dana's face was as red as a pepper, and his eyeballs were fluttering in their sockets.
"You win!"
Roy cried.
"Ugh!"
Dana's breath was foul, but his body odor was ferocious. Roy turned his head away to gulp some fresh air. Beneath them, the ground was soft, and the soil was as black as coal. Roy guessed that they'd fallen in somebody's garden. They lay there for what seemed like forever while Dana recovered from the pursuit. Roy felt smushed and uncomfortable, but it was no use trying to squirm loose. Dana was dead weight. Eventually he stirred, tightened his hold on Roy, and said,
"Now I'm going to kick your butt, Eberhardt."
"Please don't do that."
"You mooned me."
"It was a joke. I'm really sorry."
"Hey, you moon somebody and that's it. You get your butt kicked."
"I don't blame you for being PO'd," Roy said. Dana slugged him in the ribs, but there wasn't much muscle in the punch.
"Think it's funny now, cowgirl?"
Roy shook his head no, faking like he was hurt. Dana grinned malevolently. His teeth were nubby and yellow, like an old barn dog's. Kneeling on Roy's chest, he hauled back to hit him again.
"Wait!"
Roy squeaked.
"For what? Beatrice the Bear ain't here to save you this time."
"Siggies," Roy said in a confidential whisper.
"Huh?"
Dana lowered his fist.
"What did you say?"
"I know where there's a whole case of cigarettes. If you promise not to beat me up, I'll show you."
"What kind of cigarettes?"
Roy hadn't thought out that detail when he was cooking up the phony story. It hadn't occurred to him that Dana would be picky about his brand of smokes.
"Gladiators,"
said Roy, remembering the name from a magazine advertisement.
"Gold or light?"
"Gold."
"No way,"
Dana exclaimed.
"Way,"
Roy said. Dana's expression wasn't hard to read. He was already scheming to keep some of the cigarettes for himself and sell the rest for a tidy profit to his buddies.
"Where are they?"
He climbed off of Roy and yanked him upright to a sitting position.
"Tell me."
"First you gotta promise not to beat me up."
"Sure, man, I promise."
"Ever again," Roy said. "For all time."
"Yeah, whatever.
I want to hear you say it." Dana laughed in a patronizing way.
"All right, little cowgirl. I'll never, ever, ever pound on your sorry butt again, okay? Swear on my father's grave. That good enough for you?"
"Your father's still alive," Roy pointed out.
"Then I swear on Natalie's grave. Now tell me where those gladiator golds are stashed. I ain't kidding."
"Who's Natalie?" Roy asked.
"My mother's parakeet. That's the only dead person I know."
"I guess that'll do." Based on what Roy had seen of the Matherson household, he had an uneasy feeling that poor Natalie hadn't expired of natural causes.
"So, we cool?"
Dana asked.
"Yeah,"
said Roy. It was time to turn the big dummy loose. The sun had dropped into the gulf, and the streetlights were coming on. Roy said,
"There's an empty lot at the corner of Woodbury and East Oriole."
"Yeah?"
"In one corner of the lot, there's a construction trailer. That's where the cigarettes are stashed." "Sweet, a whole case," Dana said greedily. "But how come you know about it?"
"'Cause me and my friends hid them there. We swiped them off a truck at the Seminole Reservation."
"You?"
"Yeah, me." It was a fairly believable yarn, Roy thought. The Indian tribe sold tax-free tobacco products, and smokers came from miles away to stock up.
"Whereabouts inside the trailer?" Dana demanded.
"You can't miss them," Roy said. "You want me to? I'll show you." Dana snorted.
"No thanks, I'll find them."
He placed two fingers in the center of Roy's chest and gave a stiff shove. Roy flapped back into the flower bed, his head coming to rest in the same soft indentation. He waited a minute or so before getting up and brushing himself off. By then, Dana Matherson was long gone. Roy would have been disappointed if he wasn't. Curly made it through Friday night, though not without personal inconvenience. First thing Saturday morning, he drove to the hardware store and bought a sturdy new seat for the toilet in the trailer, plus a dozen jumbo rat traps. Then he stopped at the Blockbuster and got a movie in case the TV cable went out again. From there, he headed home, where his wife informed him that she would need the pickup truck, since her mother was taking the other car to the bingo hall. Curly didn't like anyone else driving his pickup, so he was sulking when his wife dropped him off at the trailer. Before settling down in front of the television, Curly took out his gun and made a quick tour of the property. Nothing appeared to have been disturbed, including the survey stakes. He began to believe that his presence was indeed keeping intruders away from the construction site. Tonight would be the true test. Without the pickup truck parked near the trailer, the place would appear deserted and inviting. As he walked the fence line, Curly was pleased not to come across a single cottonmouth moccasin. That meant he could save his 5 remaining bullets for serious security threats, though he didn't want a repeat of the nerve-rattling fiasco with the field mouse. Determined to discourage uninvited rodents, Curly carefully baited the rat traps with peanut butter and placed them at strategic locations along the outside walls of the trailer. Around 5 o'clock, he nuked a frozen dinner and popped the movie into the VCR. The turkey pot pie wasn't half bad, and the cherry strudel turned out to be surprisingly tasty. Curly didn't leave a crumb. Unfortunately, the movie was a disappointment. It was called The Last House on Witch Boulevard 3. And one of the co-stars was none other than Kimberly Lou Dixon. A clerk at the Blockbuster had helped Curly find the film, which had been released several years earlier before Kimberly Lou Dixon signed on for the Mother Paula TV commercials. Curly guessed it was her very first Hollywood role after retiring from beauty pageants. In the movie, Kimberly Lou played a pretty college cheerleader who got hexed into a witch and started boiling the star football players in a basement cauldron. Her hair was dyed fiery red for the part, and she wore a fake nose with a rubber wart on the tip of it. The acting was pretty lame, and the special effects were cheesy, so Curly fast-forwarded to the end of the tape. In the final scene, the hunk college quarterback escaped from the cauldron and threw some sort of magic dust on Kimberly Lou Dixon, who turned from a witch back into a pretty cheerleader before collapsing in his arms. Then, as the quarterback was about to kiss her, she morphed into a dead iguana. Curly turned off the VCR in disgust. He decided that if he ever got to meet Kimberly Lou Dixon in person, he wouldn't mention The Last House on Witch Boulevard 3. He switched to cable and found a golf tournament, which made him drowsy. First prize was $1 million and a new Buick, but Curly still couldn't keep his eyes open. When he awoke, it was dark outside. A noise had startled him from his nap, but he wasn't sure what it was. Suddenly he heard it again. Snap! Instantly a cry rang out, possibly human, but Curly wasn't sure. He muted the TV and grabbed for his gun. Something, an arm, a fist, thumped against the aluminum side of the trailer. Then came another snap, punctuated by muffled profanity. Curly crept to the door and waited. His heart was thumping so hard, he was afraid the intruder might hear it. As soon as the doorknob began to jiggle, Curly went into action. He lowered a shoulder, let out a marine-style roar, and crashed out of the trailer, snapping the door off its hinges. The intruder let out a cry as he hit the ground in a heap. Curly pinned him there with a heavy boot on the midsection.
"Don't move! I won't! I won't! I won't!"
Curly lowered the gun barrel. By the light from the trailer, he could see that the burglar was just a kid. A large, lumpy kid. He had accidentally stumbled upon the rat traps, 2 of which were attached crookedly to his sneakers. That has to hurt, Curly thought.
"Don't shoot me! Don't shoot me!" the kid cried.
"Aw, shut up!"
Curly stuck the .38 in his belt.
"What's your name, son?"
"Roy. Roy Everhart."
"Well, you're in deep doo-doo, Roy."
"Sorry, man. Please don't call the cops, okay?"
The boy began to wiggle, so Curly pressed down harder with his boot. Looking across the lot, he noticed that the padlock on the gate had been broken with a heavy chunk of cinder block.
"You must have thought you was pretty slick," he said, "sneaking in and out of here whenever you pleased. You and your smart-ass sense of humor."
The boy raised his head.
What are you talking about? Don't play dumb, Roy. You're the one yanked out all the survey stakes and put them gators in the porta-johnnies.
What? You're crazy, man.
And painted the cop car? No wonder you don't want me calling the police.
Curly leaned closer.
What's your problem, boy? You got a gripe with Mother Paulus? To be honest, you look like a kid that enjoys a good pancake.
I do. I love pancakes.
Then what's the deal? Curly said. Why are you doing all this stuff?
But I never even been here before.
Curly removed his foot from the kid's belly.
Come on, kid. Get up.
The boy took his hand, but instead of letting Curly pull him to his feet, he yanked Curly to the ground. Curly managed to get one arm around the boy's neck, but he twisted free and hurled a handful of dirt into Curly's face. Just like in that stupid movie, Curly thought as he clawed miserably at his eyes, except I'm not turning into a cheerleader. He cleared the crud from his vision just in time to see the boy run off, the rat traps clattering like castanets on the toes of his shoes. Curly attempted to give chase, but he made it only about 5 steps before tripping in an owl hole and falling flat.
I'll get you, Roy! He hollered into the darkness. You're out of luck, mister!
Officer David Delenko had Saturday off, which was fine. It had been a hectic week, culminating in that weird scene at the emergency room. The missing dog bite victim still had not been found or identified, though Officer Delenko now had a green shirt to match the torn sleeve he'd found on the fence at the Mother Paulus construction site. The boy who'd fled from the hospital must have left the shirt on the antenna of Officer Delenko's squad car, obviously as some sort of joke. Officer Delenko was tired of being the butt of such jokes, though he was grateful for the fresh clue. It suggested that the emergency room runaway was one of the Mother Paula's vandals, and that young Roy Eberhardt knew more about the case than he was admitting. Officer Delenko figured that Roy's father would get to the bottom of the mystery, given his special background in interrogations. The policemen spent the afternoon watching baseball on television, but both Florida teams got creamed. The Devil Rays lost by 5, the Marlins by 7. Around dinner time, he opened his refrigerator and discovered there was nothing to eat but 3 individually wrapped slices of Kraft processed cheese. Immediately, he embarked on a trip to the mini-mart for a frozen pizza. As was his new routine, Officer Delenko made a detour toward the Mother Paula's property. He still hoped to catch the vandals, whoever they were, in the act. If that happened, the captain and the sergeant would have little choice but to take him off desk duty and put him back on patrol again, with a glowing commendation for his file. Turning his squad car onto East Oriole, Officer Delenko wondered if the trained Rottweilers were guarding the Pancake House site tonight. In that event, it would be pointless for him to stop. Nobody would mess with those crazed dogs. In the distance, a bulky figure appeared in the middle of the road. It was advancing in an odd, halting gait. Officer Delenko braked the Crown Victoria and peered warily through the windshield. As the figure drew closer, passing through the glow of the streetlights, the policeman could see it was a husky teenage boy. The boy kept his head down and seemed to be in a hurry, though he wasn't running in a normal way. It was more of a wobbly lurch. Each step made a sharp clacking sound that echoed on the pavement. When the boy came into range of the squad car's headlights, Officer Delenko noticed a flat rectangular object attached to each of his sneakers. Something very strange was going on. The police officer flipped on the flashing blue lights and stepped out of the car. The surprised teenager halted and looked up. His pudgy chest was heaving and his face was slick with sweat. Officer Delenko said, "Can I talk to you for a second, young man?"
"Nope,"
answered the boy, turning to bolt. With rat traps on his feet, he didn't get far. Officer Delenko had no difficulty catching the boy and hustling him into the caged back seat of the police cruiser. The patrolman seldom used handcuffs worked splendidly.
"Why did you run?" he asked the young prisoner. "I want a lawyer," the kid replied stone-faced.
"Cute." Officer Delenko put the squad car into a U-turn so he could take the boy to the police station. Glancing in the rearview mirror, he spotted another figure hurrying up the street, waving frantically. "Now what?" thought the policeman, stepping on the brakes.
"Whoa, wait up!"
shouted the approaching figure, his unmistakable bald head glinting under the streetlights. It was Leroy Brannett, a.k.a. Curly, the foreman of the Mother Paula's project. He was huffing and puffing when he reached the police car and drooped wearily across the hood. His face was florid and smudged with dirt. Officer Delinko leaned out the window and asked what was the matter.
"You caught him!"
the foreman exclaimed breathlessly. "Way
to go!"
"Caught who?" The policeman turned to appraise his prisoner in the back seat.
"Him! The little sneak who's been messing up our place!"
Curly straightened and pointed accusingly at the teenager.
"He tried to bust into my trailer tonight. Lucky I didn't shoot his fool head off."
Officer Delinko fought to contain his excitement. He'd actually done it. He'd caught the Mother Paula's vandal.
"I had him pinned and he got away," Curly was saying, "but not before I wrung his name out of him. It's Roy. Roy Eberhardt. Go ahead and ask him."
"I don't need to," said Officer Delinko. "I know Roy Eberhardt, and that's not him."
"What?"
Curly was fuming, as if he'd expected honesty from the young burglar. Officer Delinko said, "I assume you want to press charges."
"You bet your shiny tin badge I do. This creep tried to blind me, too. Threw dirt in my eyes."
"That's an assault," Officer Delinko said. "To go along with the attempted burglary, trespassing, destruction of private property, and so forth. Don't worry. I'll put it all in the report." He motioned to the passenger side and told Curly to hop in. "You'll need to come down to headquarters."
"My pleasure."
Curly scowled at the sullen lump in the back seat.
"You want to hear how he got those ridiculous rat traps on his tootsies?"
"Later," said Officer Delinko. "I want to hear everything." This was the big break that the policeman had been waiting for. He could hardly wait to get to the station and pry a full confession out of the teenager. From training films, Officer Delinko remembered that delicate psychology was necessary when dealing with uncooperative suspects. So in a deliberately mild voice, he said, "You know, young man, you can make this much easier on yourself."
"Yeah, right,"
the kid muttered from behind the mesh partition. "You could start by telling us your real name."
"Gee, I forget."
Curly chuckled harshly.
"Putting this one in jail's gonna be fun."
Officer Delinko shrugged. "Have it your way," he told the teenage prisoner. "You got nothing to say? That's cool. You're entitled under the law." The boy smiled crookedly.
"What if I got a question?"
"Go right ahead and ask it."
"Okay, I will," said Dana Matherson. "Either of you dorks got a cigarette I could bum?"
16. The doorbell rang while the Eberhardts were eating lunch. "On a Sunday, honestly," Roy's mother said. She believed that Sunday should be reserved for family activities. "You've got a visitor," Roy's father said when he returned from answering the door. Roy's stomach knotted because he wasn't expecting anybody. He suspected that something newsworthy must have happened last night at the Pancake House property. "One of your buddies," Mr. Eberhardt said. "He says you guys had plans to go skateboarding?" "Oh." It had to be Garrett. Roy was almost dizzy with relief.
"Yeah, I forgot."
"But honey, you don't own a skateboard," Mrs. Eberhardt pointed out. "It's all right. His friend brought an extra," said Mr. Eberhardt. Roy rose from the table hurriedly, dabbing his mouth with a napkin. "Is it okay if I go?"
"Oh, Roy, it's Sunday," his mother objected.
"Please, just for an hour?" He knew his parents would say yes. They were happy to think he was making friends at his new school. Garrett was waiting on the front steps. He started to blurt something out, but Roy signaled him to keep quiet until they were away from the house. Wordlessly, they skated the sidewalk to the end of the block, where Garrett kicked off his board and exclaimed,
"You won't believe it! Dana Matherson got busted last night!"
"No way!"
Roy was trying to act more surprised than he was. Obviously, the Mother Paula's property had been under surveillance, just as he'd anticipated.
"The cops called my mom first this morning," Garrett reported. "He tried to break into a trailer and steal some stuff."
As the guidance counselor at Trace Middle School, Garrett's mother was notified whenever a student got into trouble with the law. Garrett said,
"Dude, here's the killer. Dana told him he was you."
"Oh, nice.
What a butthead, huh?"
"And they probably believed him," Roy said.
"Not even for a minute."
"Was he alone?" Roy asked. "Anybody else get arrested?" anybody like Beatrice Leap's stepbrother? He wanted to say.
Nope, just him, Garrett said. And guess what? He's got a record.
A record?
A rap sheet, dude. Dana's been busted before, is what the cops told my mom.
Again, Roy wasn't exactly shocked by the news.
Busted for what?
Shoplifting, breaking into Coke machines, stuff like that, Garrett said. One time, he even knocked down a lady and swiped her purse. Mom made me promise not to tell. It's supposed to be a secret, since Dana's still a minor.
Right, said Roy sarcastically. You wouldn't want to ruin his fine reputation.
Whatever. Hey, you ought to be doing somersaults.
Yeah? What for?
'Cause my mom says they're gonna lock him up this time.
Juvie Hall?
No doubt, said Dana, on account of his rap sheet.
Wow, Roy said quietly. He wasn't in the mood to turn somersaults, though he couldn't deny experiencing a sense of liberation. He was tired of being Dana Matherson's punching bag. And while he felt guilty about making up a bogus cigarette story, Roy also couldn't help but think that putting Dana behind bars was a public service. He was a nasty kid. Maybe a hitch at juvenile hall would straighten him out.
Hey, want to do the skate park? Garrett asked.
Sure. Roy got on his borrowed skateboard and pushed off hard with his right foot. The whole way to the park, he never once checked over his shoulder to see if he was being stalked. It felt good, the way Sundays ought to feel. Curly awoke in his own bed, and why not? The mother Paula's vandal was finally in custody, so there was no reason to spend the night on guard at the trailer. After Officer Delenko gave him a lift home, Curly had entertained his wife and mother-in-law with a blow-by-blow account of the exciting events. For dramatic purposes, Curly had jazzed up a few of the details. In his version of the story, for instance, the surly young intruder disabled him with an expertly aimed karate chop, which sounded more serious than having dirt thrown in your face. Curly also decided it was unnecessary to mention that he'd tripped in an owl burrow and fallen. Instead, he described the chase as a breathless neck-and-neck sprint. Officer Delenko's role in the capture of the fleeing criminal was conveniently minimized. Curly's performance went over so fabulously at home that he was confident Chuck Muckle would go for it, too. First thing Monday morning, Curly would call Mother Paula's corporate headquarters to give the vice president the details of the arrest and of his own heroics. He couldn't wait to hear Mr. Muckle choke out a congratulation. After lunch, Curly sat down to watch a ball game. No sooner had he settled in front of the TV than a Mother Paula's commercial came on, promoting the weekend special, $6.95 for all the pancakes you could eat, plus free sausage and coffee. The sight of Kimberly Lou Dixon playing Mother Paula made Curly think of the cheesy movie he'd rented, The Last House on Witch Boulevard 3. He couldn't recall whether it was due back at Blockbuster that afternoon or the following day. Curly hated paying late fees on video rentals, so he decided to go to the trailer and get the tape. On the drive there, Curly was distressed to remember that he'd left something else at the construction site. His gun. During the night's commotion, he had somehow lost track of the .38 revolver. He didn't recall having it when he was riding in Officer Delenko's patrol car, so it must have slipped from his belt while he was scuffling with the kid outside the trailer. Another possibility was that he dropped it when he stepped in that darn owl hole. Misplacing a loaded gun was a serious matter, and Curly was highly annoyed with himself. When he arrived at the fenced lot, he hurried to the area where he and the teenager had wrestled. There was no .38 lying around. Anxiously, Curly retraced his steps to the owl den and pointed a flashlight down the hole. No gun. Now he was genuinely worried. He checked inside the trailer and saw that nothing had been disturbed from the night before. The door was too damaged to be reattached, so Curly covered the opening with two sheets of plywood. Then he began a methodical search, back and forth across the property, eyes glued to the ground. In one hand, he carried a heavy rock, just in case he encountered one of the poisonous moccasins. Gradually, a harrowing thought seeped into Curly's brain, chilling him like ice water. What if the teenage burglar had swiped the revolver from his waistband while they were fighting? The kid could have stashed it in a dumpster or tossed it in some bushes as he ran away.
Curly shuddered and pressed on with the hunt. After about half an hour, he'd worked his way down to the section of the property where the earth-moving equipment was parked in preparation for the site clearing. By this time, he'd almost given up hope of finding the gun. He was quite a distance from where he last remembered having it, and in the opposite direction from where the vandal had fled. Curly figured there was no possible way that the .38 could turn up so far from the trailer, unless an exceptionally large owl had picked it up and carried it there. His eyes fixed on a shallow depression in a soft patch of sand. The imprint of a bare foot. Definitely human. Curly counted the toes, just to make sure. The foot appeared to be considerably smaller than Curly's own. Smaller, too, than those of the husky teenage burglar. Farther ahead, Curly came across another footprint. And then another. And still another after that. The tracks led directly toward the row of earth-moving machines, and Curly advanced with a growing sense of unease. He stopped in front of a bulldozer and shielded his brow from the sunlight. At first he didn't notice anything wrong, but then it hit him like a kick from a mule. The driver's seat was gone. Dropping the rock that he'd been carrying for protection, Curly dashed to the next machine in line, a backhoe. Its seat had disappeared too. In a snit, Curly stomped toward the third and last piece of equipment, a grader. Again, no driver's seat. Curly spat out a cuss word. Without seats, the earth-moving machines were basically useless. The operators had to sit down in order to work the foot pedals and steer at the same time. The foreman's mind was racing feverishly. Either the kid they caught last night had a hidden accomplice, or someone else had sneaked onto the property after Curly had departed. But who? Curly wondered in exasperation. Who sabotaged my equipment? And when? Fruitlessly, he searched for the missing seats, his mood darkened by the moment. No longer was he looking forward to calling Mr. Muckle at Mother Paula's headquarters. In fact, he was dreading it. Curly suspected that the grumpy vice president would take great delight in firing him over the phone. In despair, Curly headed for the portable latrines. Having guzzled almost a whole pitcher of iced tea during lunch, he now felt like his belly was about to burst. The stress of the situation wasn't helping either. Curly armed himself with the flashlight and entered one of the traveling Johnnies, leaving the door slightly ajar in case a hasty exit was required. He wanted to be sure nobody had booby-trapped the toilet with foul-tempered reptiles again. Cautiously, Curly aimed his flashlight down the dark hole of the commode. He gulped as the beam illuminated something shiny and black in the water, but upon closer scrutiny, he saw that it wasn't an alligator.
"Perfect," Curly muttered wretchedly. "Just perfect."
It was his gun. Roy was aching to sneak over to the junkyard and visit Mullet Fingers. He wanted to find out what had happened last night at the Mother Paula's property. The problem was Roy's mother. She invoked the Sunday rule as soon as he returned from the skateboard park, and a family outing was launched. Making good on his promise, Roy's father took them out the Tamiami Trail to an Indian tourist shop that offered airboat trips through the Everglades. Roy ended up having a great time, even though the noise was so loud that it hurt his eardrums. The tall Seminole who was driving the airboat wore a straw cowboy hat. He said the engine was the same type used on small airplanes. The rush of the wind made Roy's eyes water as the flat-bottomed boat whisked across the sawgrass flats and weaved through the narrow, winding creeks. It was cooler than a roller coaster. Along the way, they stopped to look at snakes, bullfrogs, chameleons, raccoons, possums, turtles, ducks, herons, two bald eagles, an otter, and by Roy's count, 19 alligators. His father got most of the action on video, while his mother took pictures with her new digital camera. Although the airboat was very fast, the ride across the shallows was like gliding on silk. Again, Roy was astounded by the immense flatness of the terrain, the lush horizons, and the exotic abundance of life. Once you got away from all the jillions of people, Florida was just as wild as Montana. That night, lying in bed, Roy felt a strong connection to Mullet Fingers, and a better understanding of the boy's private crusade against the pancake house. It wasn't just about the owls. It was about everything, all the birds and animals, all the wild places that were in danger of being wiped out. No wonder the kid was mad, Roy thought, and no wonder he was so determined. When Roy's parents came in to say goodnight, he told them he'd never forget their trip to the Everglades, which was the truth. His mom and dad were still his best friends, and they could be fun to hang out with. Roy knew it wasn't easy on them either, packing up and moving all the time. The Eberharts were a team, and they stuck together. "While we were gone, Officer Delinko left a message on the answering machine," Roy's father said. "Last night he arrested a suspect in the vandalism at the construction site." Roy didn't say a word. "Don't worry," Mr. Eberhart said. "It wasn't the young man you told me about, the one who ran away from the hospital." "It was the Matheson boy," Mrs. Eberhart cut in excitedly. "The one who attacked you on the bus. And he tried to convince the police he was you." Roy couldn't pretend not to know. "Garrett told me all about it," he admitted. "Really? Garrett must have some inside source," Roy's father remarked. "The best," said Roy. "What else did the policeman's message say?" "That's about it. I got the impression he wanted me to ask if you knew anything about what happened." "Me?" Roy said. "Oh, that's ridiculous," his mother interjected. "How would Roy know what a hoodlum like Dana Matheson was up to?" Roy's mouth was dry as chalk. As close as he felt to his parents, he wasn't prepared to tell them he'd mooned Dana, purposely lured him toward the mother Paula's property, and then made up a story about a stash of cigarettes inside the trailer. "It's certainly a strange coincidence," Mr. Eberhart was saying. "Two different kids targeting the same location. Is it possible the Matheson boy hooked up with your friend, Beatrice's stepbrother?" "No way," Roy interjected firmly. "Dana doesn't care about the owls. He doesn't care about anything but himself." "Of course he doesn't," Roy's mother said. As his parents were shutting the bedroom door behind them, Roy said, "Hey, Dad?"
"Yes?"
"Remember how you said the pancake people could do whatever they wanted on that land if they had all the permits and stuff?"
"That's right."
"How do I check up on something like that?" Roy asked. "You know, just to make sure it's all legal."
"I suppose you'd call the building department at City Hall."
"The building department." "Okay, thanks."
After the door closed, Roy heard his parents talking softly in the hallway. He couldn't make out what they were saying, so he pulled the covers up to his neck and rolled over. Right away, he began drifting off. Before long, someone whispered his name. Roy assumed he was already dreaming. Then he heard it again, and this time the voice seemed so real that he sat up. The only sound in the bedroom was his own breathing. "Great," he thought. "Now I'm imagining things." He lay back on the pillow and blinked up at the ceiling.
"Roy?"
He went rigid under the covers.
"Roy, don't freak out."
But that's exactly what he felt like doing. The voice was coming from under his bed.
"Roy, it's me."
"Me who?" Roy's breath came in rapid bursts, and his heart pounded like a bass drum. He could feel the presence of the other person beneath him in the darkness, under the mattress.
"Me, Beatrice, chill out, man."
"What are you doing here?"
"Shh. Not so loud."
Roy heard her slide out from underneath the bed. Quietly, she stood up and moved to the window. There was just enough moon in the sky to light up her curly blonde hair and cast a reflection in her glasses.
"How'd you get in our house?"
Roy struggled to keep his voice low, but he was too rattled.
"How long have you been hiding here?"
"All afternoon," Beatrice replied.
"While you guys were gone."
"You broke in?"
"Relax, cowgirl. I didn't bust any windows or anything.
The sliding door on your porch popped right off the track.
They all do,"
Beatrice said matter-of-factly. Roy hopped out from under the sheets, locked the door, and switched on his desk lamp.
"Are you completely wacko?" he snapped at her. "Did somebody kick you in the head at soccer practice or what?"
"I'm sorry about this. I really am," Beatrice said. "It's just that things got kind of hairy at home. I didn't know where else to go."
"Oh."
Roy was instantly sorry he'd lost his temper.
"Was it Lana?"
Beatrice nodded gloomily. "I guess she fell off her broom or something."
"That really sucks."
"Yeah, her and my dad got in a huge fight. I mean huge. She threw a clock radio at his head, so he beamed her with a mango."
Roy had always thought that Beatrice Leap wasn't afraid of anything, but she didn't look so fearless now. He felt bad for her. It was hard to imagine living in a house where the grown-ups behaved so idiotically. "You can stay here tonight."